So, does that mean, what's today? I have no idea.
19th.
19th, okay. December 19th. Boy, time flies, doesn't it?
Christmas is coming.
Oh, yes. I've been inundated with, oh, I guess I can.
Yes.
I've been inundated with chores that I had been accumulating because of the when I'm teaching, all I do is prepare for class, and so all these chores have been accumulating. So I've been getting both cars worked on, all sorts of stuff. But anyway, finally, I'm done with all that. Mostly. Anyway, I thought we should talk for just a second about next week and the week after, because next week is the week after Christmas, right? And the week after is the week after New Year's Day, this is January 2nd. So I'm thinking, in fact, I don't think any other, I'll bet you, I mean, I haven't looked, does anybody know? But I bet no other Sunday schools are meeting.
Correct.
Those 2 days.
Well, I only looked for next Sunday.
Right, but
no Sunday school.
But I bet you it's also true for the January 2nd. Because right. People are going to be up, you know, on January, on for New Year's Day.
But you had up, you know, on the 31st.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, I think what we should do, so this is my plan. The big picture, of course, is we're looking at six works of William James. That's what we're doing. And it just turns out that three of them are more theoretical. Although, since he's so interested in religion, we have found plenty of digressions on religion, which is ultimately our goal, is to look at that. But anyway, pragmatism, the meaning of truth, and some problems of philosophy are all more works of pragmatic theory, I guess you'd say. And so that's our starting point, because you need to understand that before you can appreciate what he's saying about religion per se. So anyway, we spent, I don't know, three weeks, I think, on pragmatism. And we spent 2 weeks on the meaning of truth, which is a sequel, I mean, it's subtitled A Sequel to Pragmatism. It's really a hodgepodge of stuff. I mean, probably maybe some stuff he wrote for that, but also a bunch of articles that he just put in. But anyway, we spent 2 weeks on that and finished that up last week. Well, today, my goal is to do the third one, which I think we can just do in one day, depending on how much detail we want to do, but I think it's okay, which is Some Problems of Philosophy. And that will then be a natural stopping point. So that's my point. You know, we will have done the three works of theory, and then when we come back on the 9th, right, then we would do the three works on the philosophy of religion, and we'll start with The Will to Believe, which is the one the hero preached on about 2 weeks ago, and then the varieties of religious experience, and then a pluralistic universe. So those are the three works on philosophy of religion. So anyway, that would be if we don't meet for the next 2 weeks, this is a reasonable place to pause, because we will have finished the three works on theory. Does that make sense? Does everybody agree that we should take the next 2 weeks off because
sure.
of the time frames? Okay, good. So that's settled. So let's begin by looking at this last work of his, Problems of Philosophy, was actually published after his death. I don't know if he actually finished it or not, but anyway, it was published. He died in 1910, and it was published in 1911. So it may not have been fully polished. I'm not sure. But anyway, we will see here very much a reiteration of a lot of things we've seen so far, but not entirely. And the very first chapter is the most original in the sense of this is something we really haven't exactly covered before. And so I'll spend a little bit of time on it. And it starts off talking about objections to philosophy as such. And so we haven't talked about that. So let me just say a little bit about the context, what's going on, and really, really very interesting. Let me begin with an analogy. When the camera was invented, I imagine that sent ripples of angst through the painting establishment, right? I mean, are we out of a job? Because a lot of art, at least up to then, had something at least to do with faithfully depicting reality. Jan van Eyck, for example, the Northern Renaissance painter, I mean, was very much a detailed, really realist. You have to admire the skill in anybody who can do that. It's just totally beyond me. As a matter of fact, Van Eyck was so much into this realistic detail that even the backgrounds, and that's not the way you perceive something. If I'm focused on Rick, stuff over there is all a blur, but in the Van Eyck's painting, everything, even the backgrounds are in these, he must have had brushes like with one hair or something to paint these tiny little details in there. Well, anyway, though, so all of a sudden the camera is invented, and painters must have thought, oh my gosh, are we out of a job now? Because the whole reason for being is depicting reality, and cameras can do it better and cheaper and the whole deal. You know, what are we doing? Well, of course, we know that was not the end of art. And as a matter of fact, it stimulated certain movements of art and brought out the fact that art is not necessarily supposed to be a representation of reality. The whole deal with abstract art or impressionism or cubism or all these other isms that we have, I think you can probably trace it in large measure to the invention of the camera. Well, something similar is happening still with philosophy, because now William James would say, well, this is a really, really a feather in the cap of the philosophers, because William James, as you'll see in just a minute, seems to think of philosophy and science as being basically the same thing. I think that's a horribly mistaken view, but there are people in my Ollie class who at least assume that, as I can tell by some of their comments, kind of drive me nutty. But at any rate, but it certainly is true that you look at the history, say, of ancient philosophy, and look at somebody like Lucretius. I mean, that's a really striking example, but anybody will do, but Lucretius is particularly striking, and his treatise on his book on the nature of things. Lucretius was an Epicurean, and the Epicureans were atomists. They borrowed the atomic theory, and they were also hedonists, as you, I'm sure, know, and melded the whole thing together. Well, you know what? When you're reading On the Nature of Things, there's really no way you could separate the science and the philosophy. They're so thoroughly intertwined. And by the way, that's one of the things that just drives me bonkers with... Anglo-American treatments of medieval philosophy, because Anglo-American philosophy, except maybe in Catholic schools, I don't know, is so hostile to religion that when I was in graduate school, for example, God forbid that we would ever... We avert our eyes from theology. Certainly don't want to get into that. So you have all these books of selections, for example, Thomas Aquinas, where they try to somehow carve out the philosophy so we can shield our eyes from the theology and don't have to get into that. And you don't learn Thomas Aquinas that way, because it's so intertwined. But they tried to do it, but they didn't have any compunction about doing that with Lucretius, which is the melding of philosophy and science, because science is okay by their lights. But at any rate, in neither case can you really understand what's going on if you try to somehow take a razor blade and excise the philosophy and put it over here, and then the other stuff and put it over here. As a matter of fact, I think it's fair to say that any theoretical investigation prior to the Enlightenment, prior to the 18th century, was philosophy. And so the atomic theory, that's philosophy, right? The only thing that's carved out, separate, is mathematics, and you might say applied mathematics like astronomy and music theory, whatever. But everything else, if it's a theoretical study, it may be now considered to be biology. It may now be considered to be psychology. It may now be considered to be physics or chemistry or whatever. Yes.
It was also called natural philosophy.
Yes, that's true too. Yes, exactly. And you'll note the title of Newton's famous work, the Mathematical Principles of what? Natural philosophy, right? So even Newton, writing in the late 17th century, is thinking of what he was doing as a branch of philosophy. It wasn't until the Enlightenment, until the 18th century, that you really saw the beginnings of the separation of the specialized, some specialized sciences from philosophy. So, I mean, William James would say, well, that's the great triumph of the philosophers, man. They finally figured out a way, after many false starts and whatever, of coming up with things that were sort of self-replicating, and you could have a specialized group of people investigating those questions, whatever. So what's the reaction of the philosophers to this? Well, all of a sudden, you see this sort of retreat into psychology. I mean, David Hume, for example, wanted to be the Newton of the mind, right? Newton did these wonderful things with, you know, mechanics, physics. Well, he wanted to be the Newton. And Kant also, you know, both of them make philosophical points, but couch the points they make in psychological terms. So now it's as though philosophy is, what happened here? Oh, my goodness. I wonder if somebody kicked us off again. All of a sudden, we just lost the Zoom session. It says connecting. Okay, here we are again. Are we okay now? I'm not muted. Can you guys hear me? Well, I see everybody is muted, so. Okay, here we are again. We all right now? Can you see me?
You're back!
Okay, here I am. Okay, I don't know what happened.
No.
Renato?
I see the.
What was that again?
Ruben? I could see the room for a minute, but I guess you were bending over. But
yeah.
I missed about everything after you started to say you're frustrated with Western philosophers' treatment of the medievalist.
Oh, my goodness.
I missed everything after that.
Okay, well, let me recap what I was saying. I was saying that in the Middle Ages, you can't, if you really want to understand Thomas Aquinas, there's no way you can separate his philosophy from his theology. They're too intertwined. And it's similarly, if you really want to understand Lucretius, there's no way you can separate his philosophy from his science. They're too intertwined, right? And then I went on to say that any theoretical investigation prior to the Enlightenment was simply regarded as philosophy. And then Jay pointed out that, you know, we call it, I mean, at least one branch of philosophy is called natural philosophy. And then I pointed out that Newton's grand work was titled The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. But starting in around the 18th century, the more successful sub-branches of what had been called philosophy now began to be separated off as specialized sciences. And William James would think of that as a great triumph, because now we had figured out finally how to have how to actually make progress in some areas. Well, anyway, this naturally, though, had the effect of philosophers wondering, well, what do we do now? And the first reaction was to retreat into psychology. And if you look at Hume and Kant, they both of them make philosophical points, but couched in psychological language. For example, Hume, when he's talking about, remember the, I don't have it up on the board anymore, but remember the whole idea, it's really a logical distinction between truths that are known conceptually versus truths that are known experientially, remember? And remember what he calls them, relations of ideas.
Oh, yes.
Versus matters of fact. Well, idea is a psychological term, right? And these matters of fact are dependent on what? Impressions. And you have impressions of sensation, impressions of reflection, and the whole panoply of psychological language, even when he's making points of logic. And Kant is the same way. Kant has his three faculties, the faculty of sensibility, the faculty of understanding, and the faculty of reason. And there are concepts in the understanding, and ideas and reason, and the whole deal. All these distinctions in Kant are in terms of psychological language, at least. So that was the first reaction. Responding to the burgeoning separation of specialized sciences out of philosophy. Well, then guess what? Well, the same thing happens all around the turn of the 20th century when psychology begins to separate off as a specialized science all on its own. And Gottlieb Frege, as a matter of fact, famously criticized a lot of the philosophers of his era for what he called psychologism. These are not points of psychology, Frege was saying. They're not points of psychology. Their language is psychological, but the points they're making are points of logic. And to couch it in psychological language is to misstate what you're really doing when you're really talking about logic, not psychology. So then what happens in the Anglo-American world when psychology branches off? Well, guess what? Then we retreat into linguistics. So 20th century Anglo-American philosophy is all about language, philosophy of language. And you know the same thing's going to happen all over again. In fact, it maybe has happened already, that you'll have, now linguistics is a separate branch, and oh my goodness, now what are we supposed to do? Meanwhile, on the continent, because the Anglophone world is always different from the continental world, it just is. Meanwhile, on the continent, they took a different approach, and that different approach was mostly heralded by Hegel. And the Hegelian approach then is to retreat into phenomenology, which is to describe inner experience. And so on the continent, whereas in the Anglophone world, we were first of all retreating into psychologizing philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then once that became separate, then into linguisticizing philosophy. And when we have the same kind of thing happening in the continental world, the shift is over to the description of inner experience. I'm going to be talking about, this is what I'm going to talk about next semester, by the way, at OLLI. Next semester at OLLI, at AU. My long march through the history of philosophy, I'm on my last course, post-Kantian philosophy, and we're going to do a Hegel and Wittgenstein there. And exactly that's, Wittgenstein is part of the linguistic turn in the 20th century in the Anglophone world, and then Hegel is sort of the prototype of the phenomenological approach, which is simply trying to describe what inner experience is. And for them, philosophy becomes, well, all more like poetry. Not poetry per se, but I've sometimes wondered if you can read Hegel, or if, let me put it this way, Hegel, it drives everybody crazy. I told you the joke in here, didn't I? I probably did, but I'll tell it again. It's a good one. What's his name? Brand Blanchard wrote a book called On Philosophical Style, And I have not read it. I've just read about it in a couple of places. But anyway, I guess he was talking about the writing styles of various philosophers. And, you know, some philosophers are quite good writers and some are terrible, such as Kant. So there's one part he was talking about the execution of Major André by the Continental Army. Major André was a British spy captured by the Continental Army. He was executed. And then saying how various philosophers would have described the execution. And when he got to Hegel, it was something like this. A finite determination of infinity has been further determined by its own negation. Mm-hmm. So that's the way that Hegel, he says, according to Blanchard, that's the way Hegel would have described the execution of Major André. A finite determination of infinity has been further determined by its own negation. Mm-hmm. And the reason that's so accurate is Hegel could be talking about the weather or the most ordinary thing, and it would be couched in such abstract language that you read it over and you read it over and you read it over and you say, what is he talking about? What is he talking about? Finally, you figure it out after about a half an hour and you think, is that all? Well, anyway, though, I've sometimes wondered if that writing style is not, to some extent, sort of poetical. Not that it's wonderful poetry per se, but in the sense that different people might get different things out of it, you know? Because what do you do? Now, Marianne's not on, unfortunately. If I would ask the expert, because she's an English professor. She teaches poetry. But I would imagine, verify what I say, those of you who are more poetical than I am, you know, you read a poem and you discuss it, and there's a lot of subjectivity there, I would think. And, you know, this, what does this mean to you? What does this mean to you or you or me or whatever? And different people respond in different ways to different parts, maybe, of a poem. And it sort of maybe influences what they think the poem is about and that sort of thing. There's more subjectivity, in other words, if you're writing in a poetic vein. It's more subjective. Well, you're writing this weird, abstract kind of thing, which in that sense is like poetry, in the sense that you're not sure what the heck the guy's saying, you know? And it maybe just strikes you in a certain way, something like that. So I've wondered that at times, you know, if maybe that's, maybe we should think of Hegel that way. Well, anyway, though, you see, that is also reacting to the emergence of the sciences out of philosophy. Because now, what do philosophers do? Well, the phenomenologists are like the impressionist paintings, maybe. Mm-hmm. Painters, I mean. You know, something like that. Where philosophy now becomes more kind of artsy. Whereas in the Anglophone world, we're determined that it's going to stay scientific. So we jump to this science and that one separates them, we jump to this science and so forth and so on. So that's part of the background of what I was long-winded background of what I was going to read from William James. And here's James mentions three objections to philosophy, and especially objection one really clues us into how James is thinking about what the philosophical enterprise is all about. Objection one, whereas the sciences make steady progress and yield applications of matchless utility, philosophy makes no progress and has no practical applications. And here's his reply. The opposition is unjustly founded. For the sciences are themselves branches of the tree of philosophy. You see, so he's thinking of philosophy as it's really the same kind of thing as science. As fast as questions get accurately answered, the answers were called scientific. And what men call philosophy today is but the residuum of questions still unanswered. So in other words, philosophers pursue the questions that, we haven't figured out a method of pursuing where we can you know, really make progress and then branch off into a specialized branch of knowledge. It's worth, still worth pursuing these questions, but they're still vague. We're not even maybe sure what the questions are, let alone how we ought to be setting up answering them. A little bit later, he says this, philosophy in the full sense is only man thinking, thinking about generalities rather than about particulars. But whether about generalities or particulars, man thinks always by the same methods. He observes, discriminates, generalizes, classifies, looks for causes, traces analogies, makes hypotheses. Philosophy, taken as something distinct from science or from practical affairs, follows no method peculiar to itself. That's his response, that philosophy is just, as he says, the residuum. Here's another little, near the end of his discussion. He says, it's obvious enough that if every step forward which philosophy makes, every question to which an accurate answer is found, gets accredited to science, the residuum of unanswered problems will alone remain to constitute the domain of philosophy and will alone bear her name. In point of fact, this is just what is happening. Philosophy has become a collective name for questions that have not yet been answered to the satisfaction of all by whom they have been asked. It does not follow, because some of these questions have waited 2,000 years for an answer, that no answer will ever be forthcoming. 2,000 years probably measure but one paragraph in the great romance of adventure called The History of the Intellect of Man. The extraordinary progress of the last 300 years is due to a rather sudden finding of a way, of the way, in which a certain order of questions ought to be attacked, questions admitting of mathematical treatment. But to assume, therefore, that the only possible philosophy must be mechanical and mathematical, and to disparage all inquiry into the other sort of question, is to forget the extreme diversity of aspects under which reality undoubtedly exists. So that's his take on it. Any questions, comments? I've been talking a long time. Surely somebody's got questions.
Okay. I always think about William James. I mean, just a psychologist more than anything.
Yeah. Well, you see, he's still in that era where philosophy and psychology were sort of blended together. And as a matter of fact, his position at Harvard was like, the chair of philosophy and psychology, or department of something like that. Yeah, so he's still in that Hume, Kant sort of era, and of course psychology started splitting off around the turn of the 20th century. And William James, I mean, he died in 1910, so he's mostly a 19th century figure. Yeah. Anything else,
Don? I have a question.
Yeah.
May I?
Yeah.
So in the modern age, like now.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask, say, a reasonably educated person what actually fell under philosophy today in a world of specialization,
yeah,
would people? Do you think people would go much beyond moral and ethical topics to be considered philosophy?
You know, I think that's maybe true for a lot of people. Go ahead.
I was done.
Oh, okay. I think that may be true for a lot of people. I think that's mistaken. I'm of the Frege school in thinking of philosophy as really very closely bound up with logic in a very broad sense. I don't see it as just confined to ethics, but I can see that some people might think that. And then to the extent that maybe you could investigate ethical questions through biology or psychology or whatever, then that would be maybe a problem for those people. Back in the heyday of logical positivism, you would read things like, if we don't have a scientific method for answering a certain question, then we should simply just say, okay, I'm going to put that question on the shelf and not even examine it until we are able to do that. And I think that's a huge mistake, because unless somebody has even speculated about it, you're going to start from ground zero. Imagine, think about the atomic theory again, since I was talking about Lucretius earlier. Think about the atomic theory. When John Dalton, who's usually credited being the first expositor of the modern atomic theory, if he hadn't had 2,000 years worth of speculation to draw on, if he had had to start from ground zero, if everybody had followed that advice and said, well, we don't have a way of answering that question yet, so we're not even going to pursue it. Well, thanks to people like Lucretius, who had preceded him, he had a huge head start when it came to tweaking it into what we know as, you know, the modern atomic theory. So that bit of hard-headed advice, in my opinion, is way, way off base, and it's not the way life works. William James, though, keep in mind, the difference between the logical positivist and William James is this difference right here. Right? Now, William James, right, has this hugely expansive criterion of truth, of meaning and truth, the pragmatic method, I guess you could say, which if it's relevant somehow to your life, it's something you can pursue. And so, therefore, there's no reason to exclude it, even though the kinds of evidence that it would be based on are weaker than the kinds of evidence that we think are required for something to be scientific. That's okay, says William James. That's the way life is in many cases. So that's why he can say it's still worth pursuing these residua, let's say, that are still out there that have not yet been swept under in some sort of corner that's now the private property of some sort of scientific discipline. Objection two. Philosophy is dogmatic and pretends to settle things by pure reason, whereas the only fruitful mode of getting at truth is to appeal to concrete experience. Science collects, classes, and analyzes facts, and thereby far outstrips philosophy. Reply: this objection is historically valid. So he agrees with the objectors. Too many philosophers have aimed at closed systems established a priori, etc., etc. Okay. So the second one, since philosophers are the only men thinking about things in the most comprehensive possible way, they can use any method whatever freely. Philosophy must in any case complete the sciences and must incorporate their methods. Okay. Objection number three. Philosophy is out of touch with real life for which it substitutes abstractions. The real world is various, tangled, painful. Philosophers have, almost without exception, treated it as noble, simple, and perfect, ignoring the complexity of fact, indulging in a sort of optimism that exposes their systems to the contempt of common men and to the satire of such writers as Voltaire and Schopenhauer. The great popular success of Schopenhauer's... Okay, well, reply. This objection is also historically valid, but no reason appears why philosophy should keep aloof from reality permanently. You know, that's really not very fair. I mean, you got plenty of very hard-nosed philosophers out there. They're not all Platonic idealists by any means. So, but anyway, he goes on to talk about, it's almost like a rehash of the old distinction that he made in pragmatism between tender-minded and tough-minded thinkers, right? Or temperaments, tender-minded versus tough-minded temperaments. He goes on in the next chapter to say, as we survey the history of metaphysics, we soon realize that two pretty distinct types of mind have filled it with their warfare. And then here he calls them, under their more typical names, the rationalists versus the empiricists. The rationalists being the tender-minded types, more speculatively oriented and that sort of thing. And the empiricists being more factually oriented. He says that. Rationalists are men of principles. Empiricists, men of facts. But since principles are universals and facts are particulars, perhaps the best way of characterizing the two tendencies is to say that the rationalist that rationalist thinking proceeds most willingly by going from wholes to parts, while empiricist thinking proceeds by going from parts to wholes. Rationalists prefer to deduce facts from principles, Empiricists prefer to explain principles as inductions from facts. So yes, this is back to the old tried and true idea that he proclaimed in his essay, Pragmatism Between Tender-Minded Thinkers and Tough-Minded Thinkers. He goes on in the next couple of chapters. There's several other, one chapter is contrasting percepts and concepts, and the other set of chapters is contrasting the one and the many. And in all these cases, what he's thinking is this. I'll just put it up here. I can get rid of this. So we have rationalists, empiricists, right, and principles, facts, right, whole or wholes, parts, and deduction. Induction, and then concepts, percepts, and then monism, that's the one, monism, and pluralism here. So, I mean, this is the, you know, the contrast that he's carrying all the way through. And under the concept percept contrast, we have yet another statement of the pragmatic method. Yet another statement. And this is this is just as sloppy as everything else he says. Let me put it that way, honestly. Now, however beautiful or otherwise worthy of stationary contemplation, the substantive part of a concept may be, because that's the difference between concepts and percepts as he sees it. Percepts are sensitive, or have to be, to the flux of experience, the phrase stream of experience is William James's phrase. In other words, experience as we perceive it is always changing. It's temporal in essence. It's essentially temporal. Concepts are atemporal, right? They're just they're abstractions. They're ways of thinking, but they're static, right? Mm-hmm. And for James, he's very anti. Well, it should be obvious. He's anti-rationalist. And therefore anti any sort of worldview such as the Platonic view where concepts take precedence over percepts. If he has to say P and not P in the same sentence, that's better, he would think, if it's somehow capturing reality, even though it's an outright contradiction, than just saying either P or not P. However, worthy of stationary contemplation, the substantive part of a concept may be, the more important part of its significance may naturally be held to be the consequences to which it leads. So if you're going to have, and of course we have to use concepts. He's not saying we shouldn't use concepts. But the point is, percepts take precedence over concepts. And what is the cash value, as he says, what's the cash value of a concept? It's, as he says here, the consequences to which it leads. This is standard pragmatic language here. These may lie either in the way of making us think or in the way of making us act. Either one. Whoever has a clear idea of these knows effectively what the concept practically signifies. Whether its substantive content can be interesting in its own right or not. It's the old purse rule that, you know, how is this going to affect either the way I think or the way I act? That's the meaning of the term. But then he goes on. The consideration has led to a method of interpreting concepts to which I shall give the name the pragmatic rule. The pragmatic rule is that the meaning of a concept may always be found, if not in some sensible particular which it directly designates, then in some particular difference in the course of human experience which its being true will make. Test every concept by the question, what sensible difference to anybody will its truth make? Well, now you're sounding like a positivist again. You know, it's going to have a difference in observational content. But I thought it had something to do, in your last paragraph, I thought it had something to do with how I think and how I act. Now all of a sudden we're talking, we're going back and forth between what sounds like narrow positivist language, and then next thing you know, we're talking about how does it influence your life, and that's sort of the what are the practical consequences. In two adjacent paragraphs, no less. Anyway, and you will be in the best possible position for understanding what it means. I said that. If questioning whether a certain concept be true or false, you can think of absolutely nothing, and you can think of nothing that would practically differ in the two cases. You may assume that the alternative is meaningless and your concept is no distinct idea. If two concepts lead you to infer the same particular consequence, then you may assume that they embody the same meaning under different names. And let me illustrate this with Peirce's we've talked about this. Let me illustrate this with Peirce's example of transubstantiation, right? Okay, you take James's second paragraph, which sounds very positivistic, and ask the question, what sensible observations does a transubstantiationist theory predict versus a non-transubstantiationist theory? In other words, the person who says we're eating the blood and body of Christ, and the person who says we're eating a wafer and drinking wine, okay? What observational differences are they going to amount to? And the answer is zero. They predict the same observations. So in the William James of the second paragraph I read, just read you, along with Peirce, would say there's no difference. There seems to be a difference, but there is no difference because they predict the same observation. But you go back to the first paragraph that I read a second ago. Now, all of a sudden, does it make a difference in how I think and how I act? And then we talked about that. Well, the transubstantiationist person might say, yeah, it makes a big difference in my feeling, in my feeling of salvation, in my way I behave toward my fellow humans, and all of that makes a big difference. Well, which is it, William James? Is it paragraph number two or paragraph number one? Come on, you know? For him, it's number one. It's got to be number one. That's the big circle that I just did. Well, here's another big circle, right? So let me read some examples. This drives me crazy. Oh yeah, here we go. Instances are hardly called for. They're so obvious. That A and B are equal, for example, means that either you will find no difference when you pass from one to the other, or that in substituting one for the other in certain operations, you'll get the same result both times. Substance means that a different group of sensations will occur. Oh, okay, well, okay. He goes on, infinite means either that you can count as many units as in part as you can as in a whole. But anyway, I'm going to jump to freedom means no feeling of sensible restraint. Really? Okay. Necessity means that your way is blocked in all directions save one. God, this is the one I was getting to. You'll be glad to know that God means that you can dismiss certain kinds of fear. Oh, really? God means I can dismiss certain kinds of fear. So if I say I believe in God, then I believe in the dismissal of certain kinds of fear. Really? That's the same? I don't think so. Yeah. But yeah, that's the practical consequence. Remember, he says theism gives you a moral holiday. And what he meant by that is God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. It's all going to come out okay in the end because God is in control of the universe. And so I can rest assured that however bleak things look, that ultimately good will triumph over evil, right?
that.
That's what he, go ahead.
But as long as you, I mean, that belief comes as long as you do what is, you have learned to be the right things to do.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just say, that's a matter, I can just be a rascal and God will take care of it
yeah.
anyway.
Or
no,
say,
no, 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 that doesn't work.
Yeah.
It works only in combination that you truthfully believe that I'm going to be honest and truthful and caring.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that, then I'm in good hand because things are going to work just fine.
Yeah. Or the other temptation is to say, well, I don't have to do anything.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, I see evil out there in the world, and I could do something about it, say. I could vote or sit down, stand out in the corner and for the sign or whatever. But God's going to take care of it, though. You know, yeah, I mean... Right.
You have your pick.
Mm-hmm.
You decide what
Don,
you want
can,
to do.
Yeah, yes. Go for it.
Don, I'm wrestling with... I'm not sure what James would... Let's just say a modern philosophical debate about the death penalty.
Right.
Where two people were laying out all the moral and conceptual and practical consequences of being for or against, right?
Uh-huh.
We've all heard them all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if James sat in on a serious discussion of that,
mm-hmm.
what would he think? Because both sides are saying practical consequences, both sides are being conceptual, et cetera, et cetera. What would he think?
Well, I think, you know, he would say, this is analogous to the question that we wrestled with a few weeks ago about the rationalist of 1650, who is... moved by the Ptolemaic system, but recognizes the importance of Galileo's discovery supporting the Copernican system. And so the being moved by the Ptolemaic system is indeed a practical consequence, right? But it doesn't have as much weight as observing the phases of Venus in terms of evidence. So isn't that similar? I mean, so we have arguments on both
no,
sides.
No, but I picked an example that does not have a scientific answer.
Of course. Exactly. So, I mean, in other words,
so
go ahead.
Would he be saying that both sides are doing good philosophy?
Not
or
necessarily.
Would he say both sides are doing good?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's still a matter. We still have to weigh things. Remember, the pragmatic rule, if I can call it that, all it's saying is we have to count as data more than what a narrow positivist would say, more than just pure scientific data. We have a broader understanding of what data would be. So in the case of your example about the death penalty, that was what it was, right? There are data out there. You still have to assess which side has a more compelling case. You're right, it's not scientific. But that's okay. And so James would sit in on the debate, and I suppose he would say, well, I think the more compelling case is X. Isn't that possible?
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of very slippery questions out there about which people disagree. And it's because we don't have really solid ways of adjudicating those issues. But that doesn't mean you can't rationally weigh the evidence and come down on one side or the other, realizing you might be wrong, of course, but that's the best we can do. I don't have a problem. I don't think that's a problem for him. My major gripes have to do with just his general sloppiness of his writing style and not being very... But again, I guess he doesn't think much of concepts, so why would he try to be careful? You know. I'll just go on just a little bit because I want to be able to put this. We don't have choir today, so I'm going to go on just a few minutes. As far as concepts versus percepts goes, he says he makes two points. He says concepts are secondary formations, inadequate and easily, and only ministerial, okay, well, whatever that means, And they falsify, that's number one. Number two, they falsify as well as omit and make the flux impossible to understand. And he goes on, number one, so, and this is obvious given the pragmatic rule, conception is a secondary process, not indispensable to life. It presupposes perception. Why? Because what does my concept mean? Well, it's the practical consequences, right? So in order to even say what a concept means, you've got to subordinate it to what you observe, to perceptions. So that's the first point. To understand a concept, you must know what it means. It means always some this, and so forth and so on. Number two, conceptual treatment of perceptual reality makes it seem paradoxical and incomprehensible, wherein radically and consistently carried out, it leads to the opinion that perceptual experience is not even reality at all, but just an appearance or an illusion. And the problem there is, William James is very fond of his idea of a stream of experience. And so percepts are faithful to the dynamism and the flux of the world, right? To the time-based part of the world. Concepts are thinking about things statically. Therefore, they falsify the way the world really is. So that's the second reason why you have to radically, if you have things set up in this bifurcated way here, you have to radically orient try this one yourself in this direction, right? I mean, we got to use concepts. He's not saying you can't use concepts at all, but they need to be rigorously subordinated to percepts, because I suppose from James's point of view, the worst philosopher out there was Plato, who says that the true world, i.e. the world of forms, is unchanging, it's completely static, and everything else is a less true, a more distorted picture of reality. And that's because it introduces the time element. Well, James is saying, that's got it exactly backwards. The way the world really is, it's in time, and the only part of your experience that correctly portrays the world the way the world really is your percepts, not your concepts. So that's why I drew that line going in that direction. And so then that's finally followed, and I'll end with this, by the one and the many, that once again, rationalists, I don't know if you probably can't even see this because this is so faint, rationalists tend toward monism, it's a tendency. Empiricists tend toward pluralism. I suppose something like the Bhagavad Gita would be the most radically monistic, one of the most radically monistic treatises ever written. But obviously James is preferring the latter, because he wrote a book called The Pluralistic Universe that we're going to talk about, right? And the problem with monism, he has four problems with monism. Number one, it does not account for our finite consciousness. I have a consciousness, so do you, and you, and all you guys out there. We all have our individual consciousnesses, but if there's only one consciousness, like Hegel, if there's just consciousness with a capital C, that falsifies reality. I have a finite consciousness, not the same as the consciousness of with a capital C. It's not, you know, a finite determination of infinity. Number two, it creates the problem of evil. Why? Because we have a concept of God, and we have concepts of benevolence and omnipotence and all this stuff, and there's a conflict between those concepts. It's all because we conceptualize, or try to conceptualize God, and it results in these anomalies that we can't figure out, right? But you got to get away from that. Number three, it contradicts the character of reality as experienced, which is what I've said all along. We experience reality as a flux. And if we're thinking of it conceptually, or I'm sorry, this is monistically, if we're thinking of it monistically, we experience reality as a flux and also plural. And if we think of it monistically, obviously that's completely falsifying the way we experience the world. You know, we experience many things out there and they change. No, we don't experience Brahman, although in defense of that, they would say, well, that's a mystical experience. But we'll get to that. And number four, it's fatalistic. And again, and then the Bhagavad Gita is a textbook example of that. The whole point that Arjuna learns when he has this divine sight granted to him by Krishna is that everything is determined. You know, you may think you have free will, but you really don't. It's all, the book has already been written, and you're just an actor in the play. You know, you're just carrying it out. So for those reasons, monism is inadequate. So in stacking up the rationalist versus the empiricist approaches, and these last two, concepts versus percepts, monism versus pluralism, he talks about in detail, and in both cases emphasizes the inadequacy of the rationalistic approach and the fact that it needs to be radically subordinated to the empiricist approach. Okay, and so that's where we're going. Yeah. So what we'll do then, just to remind everybody, we won't meet next week, we won't meet the week after next, but we will get back together on the 9th of January, and we will begin talking about the will to believe and all the religious treatises, the three religious works that he wrote. So everybody, if I don't see you before, I probably will, but anyway, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, the whole deal, right? All right, bye-bye, people.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.